has a lot of writing to do. Okay, there we go. All right, good morning. We are getting close to the end of Daniel in our studies of visions of God. We are in chapter 11. And why I have all this detail written here on the board is that this is kind of the culmination of the zooming in that we've seen across the book of Daniel. And I'm gonna do a little bit of a reprise through the other prophecies we've seen in Daniel, because they're all talking about historical situations, and in particular the rise and fall of empires, the rise and fall of kings. And the theme of the book, you know, being God is in control, period. And Daniel said it right in the verse of it. He says, God sets up kings and he takes down kings. And that's the whole activity of what we see in the book. So, we finished last time. We went through chapter 10 and we had, you know, the vision of the angelic being that comes to see Daniel. And he's telling him, you know, you started praying. You prayed and fasted for 3 weeks. You know, as soon as you started praying, I was sent to you, but it took me 3 weeks to get here because the prince of Persia held me up until Michael, one of the chief princes, came and helped me. It was just basically talking about struggles between angelic beings who were either for or against the will of God. And then he says that when I leave, the prince of Greece will come. I'm going to go back with the prince of Persia, the kings of Persia, and then the prince of Greece will come. Now, when we get into this chapter 11, it is incredibly detailed. And it covers a period of around 400 years. And when you realize that this is an angel talking to Daniel, and he says, this is what's going to happen, you know, it's really pretty amazing. It's not amazing because it's from God. We kind of get used to amazing from God. But just the amount of detail here. What I have here on the board is a table that my daughter, Sarah Harrison, prepared. She did a really excellent scholarly paper and went back and looked at all of these references. In this chapter, you're going to hear a lot of people called the King of the North and the King of the South, and it goes through a bunch of different generations of them. And she went back through history and lined it all out. Found, okay, this was this king, this was this king. He had a daughter, you know, she married that king. They had a son, he ruled, he got conquered, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I have the paper if you'd like to read it, and if you really like history, it's a great paper. But what I did here was I just outlined the verses in this chapter and the rough year, the approximate year, and then who's the king of the north and who's the king of the south being talked about. Now, we're going to read it before we go through that, but I want you to think for a second. If you were living in Daniel's time and you read this chapter, you wouldn't have any idea who specifically it was talking about, because it was future, right? Unless it says there's going to be a king and his name's going to be Antiochus Epiphanes, you wouldn't know. You'd say, well, there's this king coming and he's going to do this to this king, and these kings are going to go have a battle, and these kings are going to make an alliance. Even if you look at the first century, a lot of this information, at least some interesting chunks of it, is available then, because the historians of the day, Josephus being one of them, and we have lots and lots of his writings, document some of these situations that went on. But when you think of it even today, the reason, and lots of books have been written on trying to interpret this chapter in a historical context, we have extreme advantage over prior generations because we have the wonderful internet, right? Where if you were trying to figure this out, you were just reading Daniel and you wanted to, you'd go to a library, maybe a university. You'd go try to find books that talk about history in this time period. You'd read through those books. It'd take a lot of time. You'd go write down a whole bunch of notes for yourself. You might spend your whole life trying to piece all this together. Of course, now we just go into a search engine and we just say, oh, tell me about the Seleucid Kingdom. and you'll get 150 PhD papers written on the history of the Seleucid Kingdom. And, you know, once you look at two or three of them, you remember, you know, something, there's a pattern here. They seem to be talking about the same thing. We can do research at such an incredible scale now, with such ease, that we have a distinct advantage in looking at these things. But, I want to put this in the context. So remember back in the very first vision in Daniel, the vision of the great idol, right? The vision of the great idol, and we had, you know, the dream was interpreted and said, "You, King Nebuchadnezzar, are that head of gold," right? So we knew that this was the Babylonians. Then there will be an empire that rises after you. There'll be an empire that rises after them. There'll be one of silver, one of bronze. The empire that rises after them will be legs of iron, and they will crush everything. But they're going to be partly brittle and partly strong because their toes are going to be mixed with clay and iron. So then we have another dream that says there's a lion with the heart of a man. And then there's a bear, and then there is a leopard with four heads and four wings, and then there's a great beast. And I've just kind of characterized it as a T-Rex, because it talks about a great beast, it had great iron teeth, and it stomps everything, and it tears everything up. Then we have another dream, or another vision, that Daniel has, and it says there was a ram, and it had lopsided horns. And the bear, remember, was lopsided. He stood up on one side more than the other. And there was a he-goat. And the he-goat and the ram fought against each other. And the he-goat had one horn, and he broke the ram's horns, and he stomped him to bits. And then, in the middle of his power, that one horn was broken off, and it was replaced by four horns. Okay, so we had one horn to four horns. And the horns here, and there were two horns here, the Medes and Persians, we know when he talks about here, he says, these are the kings of Medes and Persians, so we know what this is. This is the Medo-Persian Empire. It came right after the Babylonian Empire. They're the ones that took over. You remember Belshazzar's feast, the writing on the wall. That's that transition. That's this transition right here. Belshazzar's feast, the writing on the wall, was a switch from the Babylonian to the Medo-Persian Empire. The Medo-Persian Empire included the Medes and the Persians. So Darius was in there. Cyrus the Persian was in there. We know Cyrus because Cyrus said, "Time to go home, Jews. Time to go back and rebuild Jerusalem." Right. So this is all historical. So when you get down to this, remember Daniel was having this dream, and I mean, he was fasting, and this angelic being comes to him and says, "I'm going to go back to the kings of Persia, and when I do, the king of Greece will come." So he's talking about this transition right here. That's the transition, and here you see the ram and the he-goat are going to fight with each other. The Medo-Persian ram is going to be conquered by the Grecian, and it says, the king of Greece. So it tells you really clearly who it is. The great king of Greece, Alexander the Great, he's going to take over, and then he's going to die, and his kingdom is going to be split up into four pieces that go to the four winds, the four horns that go to the four directions. So he says that's the transition. That he said, first of all, there's a transition that's going to happen here. Then there's a transition that's going to happen here. And he's giving him more and more detail. That's why I said this is a roadmap. Now, what we're about to see is the detail of this area right here. The detail of the Greek Empire. So here's the Greeks. And then down here, of course, is the Romans. And we know that because when this one, it's the one that follows the Greek Empire historically. It's also the one that had the, because of its expansion, its use of client kings, the strength and brittleness of those alliances. And remember, at the end of that vision, it says, "And there was a stone cut out without hands that strikes the image on its feet and breaks it into pieces. And that stone grows into a mountain that fills the whole earth." And when it's interpreted, it says, "And after this 10 times of these kings, another kingdom will arise that will never be given to another people. It will be an everlasting kingdom." So we know what that is. That's the church. It's Christ and the church. So what you have here is Babylonians, Medo-Persians, Greeks, Romans, and then the eternal kingdom of Christ. So we know what time period historically he's talking about here. by looking at those things and by the direct mention in the book, it says the king of Greece, the king of Persia. You know, it makes it clear. But what we're about to go into in chapter 11 is the most detailed historical prophecy in the Bible. By far the most detailed. Probably the only one close to it is in Isaiah. Remember when Hezekiah was telling Isaiah, here's what the king of Assyria is going to do. You know, he's going to sweep down and he's going to take over some things. He's going to come back to Jerusalem. He's going to stand up. He's going to stop here and fix his, says he's going to stop here and fix his sandal. And then he's going to come to Jerusalem and then he's going to be turned away. It's even more than that. So, chapter 11. Now, chapter 11 in context, let's read the last part of chapter 10 for a second. So this is still, the angel is talking to Daniel. Verse 20. Then he said, do you know why I am come to you? And now I must return to fight with the prince of Persia. And when I have gone forth, indeed the prince of Greece will come. But I will tell you what is noted in the scripture of truth. No one upholds me against these except Michael, your prince. Now, chapter 11. Also, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will arise in Persia, and a fourth will be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then a mighty king shall rise, who shall rule with great dominion, and do according to his will. And when he is arisen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided to the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion but with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted, even for others besides these. Also the king of the south shall become strong, as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And at the end of some years they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north and make an agreement, but she will not retain the power of her authority, neither he nor his authority shall stand. But she shall be given up, and with those who brought her, and him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. But from a branch of her root shall one arise in his place, who shall come with the army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. And also the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. However, his sons shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. And the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude. But the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. For the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. Now in those times many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand him. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. But he who comes against him shall do according to his own will, and no one shall stand against him, and he shall stand in the glorious land with destruction in his power. And he shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom, and upright ones with him. Thus he shall do. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or before him. After this he shall turn his face to the coastlands, and shall take many. But a ruler shall bring a reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed he shall turn back on him. Then he shall return his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Then there shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom. But within a few days he shall be destroyed, not in anger or in battle. And in this place shall arise a vile person, to whom they will not give the honor of royalty. But he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. With the force of a flood they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. And he shall enter peaceably, even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise plans against the strongholds, but only for a time. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, and the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. Both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table. But it shall not prosper, for the end will be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the holy covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. At the appointed time he shall return and go toward the south, but it will not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him, and therefore he shall be grieved and turn in rage against the holy covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard to those who forsake the holy covenant, and forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant he shall corrupt with flattery, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many, yet for many days they shall fall by sword and famine, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for an appointed time. Then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god and speak blasphemies against the God of gods and shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished, for what has been determined shall be done. He shall regard neither the God of his fathers nor the desire of women nor regard any god, for he shall exalt himself above them all. But in their place he shall honor a god of fortresses and a god which his fathers did not know. He shall honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and pleasant things. Thus he shall act against the strongest fortresses with a foreign god, which he shall acknowledge and advance its glory, and shall cause them to rule over many and divide the land for gain. At the time of the end the king of the south shall attack him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots, horsemen, and many ships. And he shall enter the countries, overwhelm them, and pass through. He shall also enter the glorious land, and many countries shall be overthrown. But these shall escape from his hand, Edom, Moab, and the prominent people of Ammon. He shall stretch out his hand against the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape. He shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver, and over the precious things of Egypt. Also the Libyans and Ethiopians shall follow at his heels. But news from the east and the north shall trouble him. Therefore he shall go out with great fury to destroy and annihilate many. And he shall place the tents of his palace between the seas and the glorious holy mountain. Yet he shall come to his end, and no one will help him. Whew! That's one chapter, folks. That's 400 years of history condensed into one chapter. Now, you can imagine some of the complexities of trying to understand this. It keeps talking about the king of the north, the king of the south, the king of the north, the king of the south, all the way through. But it also makes it clear that these are different generations. You know, he'll fall, one of his seed will arise. You know, there's all this kind of stuff going on. So the key to trying to understand this historically is to find out who the king of the north and king of the south are, and who they are through time as they change, and look that up in history. Okay? And since my daughter did such a fine job of putting all this together in a table for me, I did a little synopsis of that table here. So, you know, the first couple of verses are really before we talk about the king of the north and king of the south. Notice what it says. First year Darius the Mede, I stood up to confirm and strengthen him. Now, I'm going to tell you, three more kings will arise in Persia, and the fourth will be greater than them all. By his strength and riches, he's going to stir up against the realm of Greece. So here we are, right? The Medes and the Persians. The last king of the Medes and the Persians is going to be really rich, really powerful. He's going to stir up everybody against Greece. This is all very historical. You can see that Alexander's father and his grandfather fought these battles. And then a mighty king shall arise, who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will, Alexander the Great. And when he has arisen, his king shall be broken up and divided for the four winds of heaven. We've already seen that in two different visions. Alexander's four generals took over the Greek Empire. It's all very well documented historically. He did have a wife. He did have a son. They were both assassinated. So it wasn't to his posterity. As it says, it wasn't given to his posterity. It was given to others. Then it says, verse 5, also the king of the south shall become strong. Now here you start talking about king of the south, king of the north. So this is around 314 BC. You have, of the four generals, there were really two great kingdoms that emerged out of that. The four generals got part of the kingdom of Alexander, but really the east and the west ones just kind of didn't last very long. So you had the north and the south. The north are called the Seleucids. The reason they're called Seleucid is Seleucus the first, who was one of the generals. And the other one was Ptolemy. And Ptolemy, so you'll have the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. So Seleucus the first, Nicator means victor. He started out, and Ptolemy the first started out in Egypt. And so now when you start seeing this in verse 5, he talks about, you know, what's going to happen. It turns out that the daughter of Ptolemy was sent up to marry Nicator and to do an alliance, and it didn't work. And they, you know, there's, you can read this stuff historically. Like I said, my daughter did this big long paper on it. It reads like a historical novel. You know, you're reading in here and there's all this intrigue going on and who's after whom and what have they done, and they go and they try to trick somebody and they lie to somebody else and then they take them over and they assassinate somebody else. It just reads like that all the way through. From a branch of her root shall one rise in his place, who shall come with an army and enter the king of the north. So here the king of the south is going up to the king of the north again. By this time we're talking about Antiochus Theos. Theos means God. So his nickname was God. Okay, you're going to see a lot of nicknames here. And he was Antiochus II. And after a while here, I just put S for Seleucus, A for Antiochus, and P for Ptolemy. So we don't write them all day long. And he goes up, and by then, you have Ptolemy II, whose name is Philadelphus. What does Philadelphus mean in Greek? You should know this. Yeah, brotherly love. Or one who loves his brother is the way you would interpret it when it's a name. Then 7 and 8, let's take a look. From that is 7 and 8. Let's see, did I miss one? I skipped one. Yeah, so Antiochus Theos and Philadelphus. Then you have Seleucus II, Callicus, which is the great conqueror. And Ptolemy III, Euergetes, who I believe his name means the benefactor. So then by the time you get to, let's see, what verses are we at here? By the time you get to verse 9, also the king of the north shall come up to the king of the south. And by the way, all these references, he shall continue more to the king, longer than the king of the north, and he shall carry gold and silver to Egypt. And there's historical reference for all these things now that we found. So it's the detail and how it lines up with history is just striking. So we have Antiochus the Great starting out in verse 9. King of the north shall come to king of the south. So here he comes down again, right? But shall return to his own land. He didn't win the battle. His sons will stir up strife and assemble a great army and will come down again. So, you know, here we've got generations going on. Here you have Antiochus the third, who was called Antiochus the Great. And you have Ptolemy the fourth, who was Philopater. Philadelph, brother, love of brother. Philopater, love of father. Or daddy's boy. Might be a colloquialism. So he was the one who was loyal to his father and loved his father. So now we go to verse 12. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up. He will cast down tens of thousands, but will not prevail. For the king of the north will come up and stir up a great army and basically shall overcome him. Notice the key, you hear some of these things in here. When his heart is lifted up. How many times have we heard that in Daniel? What was Nebuchadnezzar's biggest problem? Pride. How did God fix it? There is an antidote for pride. He made him crawl around on his hands and knees and eat grass like an ox for 7 years until he acknowledged that the Lord God reigns and puts on him the throne who he wants. So this is all about pride. This is all about pride. You'll see their names. Notice their names. The victor, you know, God, the overcomer, the one who loves his father. We're going to get down here in the next one here to Ptolemy V, whose name was Theos Epiphanes. In other words, the manifest God. That was his name. The obvious God. Or God made manifest to men. Is there a little pride in there? Just a little bit. Okay, verse 20. There shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious land, but within a few days he shall be destroyed. This is actually something, and he shall, and in his place shall ride a vile person whom they will not give the honor of royalty, and he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by entry. This is where you're talking about Seleucus the Fourth, Philopater. Notice you had Ptolemy Philopater, and now you have Seleucus Philopater. You'll see this too, that they start using each other's names. A lot of these people intermarried. And you'll find that you had Ptolemy, you know, everybody was called Ptolemy in that line. In the Seleucid kingdoms, they were either called Seleucus or Antiochus. And then all of a sudden, you're going to start hearing about Cleopatra. And we go, Cleopatra, we know Cleopatra. We've seen the movie with Elizabeth Taylor. We know who Cleopatra was. She was the one that got involved with Julius Caesar and Mark Antony and all that. This is hundreds of years before that. There are lots of Cleopatras. Cleopatra was a dynastic line of female rulers in Egypt. So there's lots of Cleopatras. But she does, you know, the name shows up here. Okay, so it turns out that this guy named Heliodorus murders Seleucus Philopater. This is the guy that comes in for a little time, is not given honor. Verse 22, with the force of a flood they shall be swept away before him and broken, and also the prince of the covenant. When you see references to the glorious land or the covenant, they're talking about the rulers or the priests or the people of Judah at the time. Okay, so this whoever happened to be the prince of the covenant, whoever happened to be the ruler of the Jews at this time, was swept away. And after a league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully. He shall come up and be strong with a small number of people. He'll enter peaceably even to the richest places and do what his father has not done. He will share the spoils from the wars. Now, let's skip down here to 22. I already did that, 22, 23. Yeah, by the time you get to with the force of a flood, he should be swept away. And this guy who enters into the kingdom, we're talking about Antiochus the Fourth. Antiochus the Fourth is also known as Antiochus Epiphanes, or the manifest or obvious one. And most of the rest of this, at least from the King of the North perspective, is talking about Antiochus Epiphanes. Antiochus Epiphanes is, he was extremely wealthy, extremely powerful, and he hung around for a long time. And he really didn't like Judaism. And he decided the whole world ought to be Greek. So he did a lot. He went into Jerusalem and forced everybody to start worshiping the Greek gods. And he's the one that went in and defiled the temple and sacrificed pigs on the altar and covered the whole area with pig broth and pig blood. And so, thus defiling the temple, and the temple remained defiled for several years before it was cleansed again. So Antiochus Epiphanes is going on. At this time, you've got Ptolemy the Sixth, who was called Philometer, mama's boy, as opposed to daddy's boy. And he ended up ruling for a period of time. He ruled solely at one point Cleopatra the Second and Ptolemy Physicon, or Physicon, whose nickname was Potbelly. He apparently was an obese pharaoh from history. They ruled together as a triumvirate, and then Philopater took back over as the sole ruler, and he goes down. Now, as you get towards the end here, there's several interesting things, just other historical notes that I want to share with you, just so we kind of keep this all in context. So, back up here in verse 12, because you could spend a whole semester just studying all the details of this history. We're not going to do that. When it talks about the king of the south coming up and having the battle of the king of the north and winning, this is actually the time period where the decree of Memphis was written in Egypt. The decree of Memphis was written on stone in three languages. One chunk of that stone was discovered by a lieutenant in Napoleon's army. It now sits in the British Museum. It's called the Rosetta Stone. And what it was talking about was the decree of Memphis, this royal decree that happened during this time period. This is where we're at. This is all real life history. There are rocks with carvings in them that tell us what's going on at this time. You also have, during the time period of Antiochus, when he found a bunch of Jews who weren't religious Jews, they just wanted to be in power, and he made them the high priest. He just said, oh, you know, everywhere you go, the high priest of the temple is just an appointed person, you know, the ruler gets to appoint who the priests are, because actually we're all in control anyway. And so what you have is this series of rich Jews buying the priesthood, bribing the king or the ruler so they'll make them the high priest. Okay, including at one point where there was whoever was the high priest was kind of considered the ruler and the priest at the same time. And so when one of them died and the only one left was his mother, who was basically in the role of queen mother like we've seen before in history, she was, at least secularly, the high priest of the temple. So this just shows you how far away they were from following God's word, right? They weren't even interested in that. This was just a power play. And if you happened to be the ruler, you also got to be the priest, or you got to choose the priest. There was a lot of infighting amongst the Jews. Notice these references to those who have understanding. Let me see if I can find that again. This is so detailed, it's hard to jump in the middle of it. Yeah, verse 35. Verse 32. Those who do wickedly against the covenant, he shall corrupt with flattery. So this is Antiochus getting the people who are apostate Jews to help him. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. So there was effectively civil war going on this time between the righteous Jews who were trying to follow God and the wicked ones. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by sword and famine, by flame, by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be aided with a little help. But many shall join them by intrigue. In other words, they're going to get infiltrated by those who are false. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still at the appointed time. So even during this period, where the land of the Jews was taken over by this pagan Greek king, and his people were in charge, you had that faithful remnant that was still there, fighting for the truth and trying to obey God. And God said they're getting beat up, aren't they? Flame, sword, right? But what is he doing? That they might be refined and made white. Where have we heard that before? How about the New Testament? How about the letters to seven churches in the book of Revelation? How about James? Count it all joy, my brethren, when you enter into trials and temptations. Right? Bad things happening to good people, like we're talking about here, is in fact, in these cases, God's will. He says, I'm going to refine you. I'm going to try you and I'm going to refine you and make you white. So the goal is to make them white. And not every bad thing that happens to people is God saying it's time for something bad to happen to you. But here's a situation where you can see what it is. Now, so you end up with a big switch that happens here around verse 30. Let's take a look at it, because this is when you're interpreting this and looking at it historically. All this stuff is talking about here about Antiochus Epiphanes is by far the largest section of the prophecy. Verse 30. Ships from Cyprus will come against him. He shall be grieved and return and rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So there's where he goes back and... Oh, by the way, do you know why he did that? Fascinating bit of history. So Antiochus Epiphanes, who's the king of the north, heads down to the king of the south, to Egypt, and wants to invade Egypt. Well, all along this time, what you actually have is you have the rise of the Roman Empire. So, you know, these things didn't just stop and start on a dime. Right? The Greeks had been going on during the Medo-Persian Empire. They still had their empire, but it was small. It was around Greece and just around the area. And it was growing and expanding. And during the Greek Empire, you had the Roman Empire growing and expanding. Well, by about this time, Greece itself had been taken over by the Romans. And the Romans are starting to show up on the scene. And it turns out that Antiochus Epiphanes goes down to Egypt to take over Egypt, to fight against Egypt. And he finds someone waiting for him at the border. His name, if I remember correctly, is Lysanias. He recognizes the guy. He's a Roman soldier, an emissary from Rome with an army. Turns out this was his childhood buddy. Fascinating story. Antiochus Epiphanes had been taken captive and taken as ransom to Rome when he was a boy. He grew up in Rome. He knew Leonidas. They were boyhood companions. Here, Antiochus Epiphanes, the great king with his great armies coming down to fight Egypt, but Egypt had made an alliance with Rome, which was this emerging empire at the time, right? It wasn't the dominant one, it was an emerging empire. So here's Leonidas, his boyhood friend. They're both men now, they're both soldiers, you know, they've fought lots of battles, and here they are at the border of Egypt. And Antiochus says, I'm going in and fighting. And he says, and Leonidas says, if you do that, Rome's going to come against you. And then Antiochus says, I need a little time to think about it. And Leonidas says something that we still use today. Took out his sword, and he walked around in a circle around Antiochus Epiphanes, drew a line in the sand. He drew a circle around it. And he says, by the time you leave this circle, you will have made your decision. And that's where the phrase "a line in the sand" comes from. It's fascinating to see how this stuff works. But that was Rome exerting its power in the region and stymieing Antiochus Epiphanes. Okay, so from that point on, you have the rise of Rome in the region and the slow degradation of the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. The Ptolemies, by the way, never again were really a strong power. They were a client of Rome. They let Rome do their work. If you go a little further, if you go down about another 100 years here, 60 to 100 years, you find Julius Caesar coming down to Egypt, finds this girl named Cleopatra who happened to be the ruler, thinks she's pretty nice. They have a child together. Turns out that Julius Caesar gets killed, and one of his lieutenants, Mark Antony, and now we're into Elizabeth Taylor and, you know, that's the story that was told in the movie. That all happens about 60, 70 years after this particular period of time we're talking about. And by then, the Romans are in control. And we've made this transition to the Roman Empire. But right at the end here, there's a couple of things that happen. And when it starts talking about, let me see the switch here, the King of the North. This is a really important thing. 36. It says, then the king shall do according to his own will. He shall exalt and magnify himself above every god, shall speak blasphemy against the God of God, shall prosper till the wrath has been accomplished. For what shall be has been determined shall be done. That phrase shows up about three different times here, over and over. This is an angel telling this hundreds of years ahead of time, and he says, this is what's going to happen, and guess what? It shall be done this way. You know, again, it's just testimony. This is prophecy being predicted by God. But he says, this king, now you get this king that's talked about, the king that does what he pleases. And then you start hearing about the king of the north, but it's not Antiochus Epiphanes anymore. And what happens is, about this period in the history, Antiochus Epiphanes is kind of shuttling back and forth between his normal power base of Syria and Egypt, right? Going back and forth across Jerusalem, causing all kinds of trouble. That's what he's doing for a couple of decades during this time period. Rome, on the other hand, has come down to Egypt and made an alliance and stopped him there. Guess what they've been doing in the north? Conquering Greece. So remember, the king of the north used to be the king who ruled over Greece. So what you have is the Romans start over here in Italy, and they've got a pincer movement going on. Right? They're coming up through Egypt, they're coming down through Greece and Turkey and Syria. And eventually that's going to combine. The Roman Empire covered the entire ring of the Mediterranean. So what you have here at this point is now when it starts talking about the king of the north, it's not talking about Antiochus anymore. He's kind of the guy caught in the middle. You got the king of the south, which is Ptolemy VI, who's allied with Rome. And you have the king of the north, who's not Antiochus anymore, but Rome coming down from the north. So this, without getting into any more of the history, which we could talk about a long time, this is showing us what happened. This is the record of this time period in the prophecy. And as you can see, it's incredibly detailed. And you know, like I said, if you're interested in reading the paper, I'd be happy to give you a copy of it. What does this show us? Daniel's not done yet, by the way. We got one more chapter to go.
It shows us what he said at the very beginning, that God sets up kings and God removes kings.
Yeah.
And God is in control.
Oh, it's also worth mentioning. You know that little section that says he will not honor the gods? First of all, he'll call himself a god, and then it says he won't honor the gods of his fathers, but he'll honor a foreign god, a god of fortresses. There's so much detail in there, you might not remember that. It turns out that there was... So the Greeks had... What were their gods? What were the Greek gods? You studied mythology.
The guy who... was did the ocean,
Poseidon,
Thor.
Whoops, you switched into Norse mythology. Thor's Norse mythology. The Greek mythology was Zeus, Demeter, Apollo, those folks. The Romans.
I'm sorry.
That's okay. The Romans, when they grew up, they adopted the Greek gods and gave them different names. So Zeus, they named Jupiter. Demeter, they named Hera. You go through these things and you see what they did. And so they basically had the same pantheon, but just with different names. But there was another god that showed up on the scene. And my best estimate of who that god is a god, a goddess called Cybele. Cybele was a foreign god that came from north of Turkey. I mean, the worship of Cybele came from north of Turkey. It is in the time period when Cybele was kind of a novelty religion in Rome, happened to be the time when Leonidas and Antiochus were boys there. As all foreign god, foreign pagan worship was, it was all about sex and barbecue, basically. So the likelihood that he got introduced to Cybele, which was not one of those standard Greek or Roman gods, happened at that point. The goddess Cybele had a crown which was a fortress wall. She was a god of fortresses, which matches the relevance here. And so, you know, it's just more and more of that detail that just comes out every time you look at it. Okay, so the last thing I want to say. What we don't have in Daniel is the rest of the Roman Empire. Right? What we have is the Greek Empire. But where's Daniel sitting when this is happening? He's right here. Remember, the guy says, I'm here, there's four more Persian kings that are going to arise, and then the king of Greece is going to come. Daniel's like right up here in the middle of the Medo-Persian Empire. So he said, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen throughout this dynasty. You've already lived through this dynasty, this empire, and I'm going to tell you what happens completely to this empire. But he also, remember the 70 weeks? Right, that we've talked about the last 3 weeks. The 70 weeks, what do we have? We had 7 years or a period, of a period of time where God's promises of restoration of the temple and the Jews to their land would be fulfilled. We had 62 sevens, which didn't say much about in that prophecy. This is what we're looking at. The 62 sevens are basically this part. And then the last seven, which it says the Messiah is going to come and be cut off, and then the power of the holy people are going to be completely shattered, and the city and the temple will be destroyed. So that's how it all pulls together. Next week we have the last chapter of Daniel, which has a very intriguing prophecy, because Daniel, after listening to all this, is pretty overwhelmed, you might imagine. And he says, what's going to be the end of all this? You know, he's just kind of overwhelmed. And he's going to be told then. Any other questions or comments? Yeah.
Right here at the end, something that we all can relate to. At the end of the chart there.
Mm-hmm.
Antiochus Epiphanes is having his trouble with Rome, and he's focusing somewhere else.
Yeah.
The Maccabeans arrive.
Yeah.
And they're able to push him out, take back over. He says, I've got trouble somewhere else. You guys can have Jerusalem back.
Yeah.
And when they take Jerusalem back, then they had what's called the Festival of Lights, mm-hmm. or what we call today Hanukkah.
Yeah.
That is the origination of Hanukkah, when they were able to push Antiochus Epiphanes out and take back mm-hmm. over the temple.
And see, during that time, from about verse 35 to the end of the chapter, Antiochus Epiphanes eventually dies, right? After that, you have Demetrius Soter, who's called Savior. You have Alexander Ballas. You have Demetrius Nicator, the victor. Antiochus Sidetes, and he's the last Seleucid king. So after Antiochus Epiphanes, which is kind of the peak of the power of the Seleucid Empire and the peak of the Greeks, you have kind of this little bit of slide here for a few decades through a few kings. But during that time, you have the rise of the Maccabean Revolt, and that is a righteous group of Jews who said, we are going to follow the law of Moses, and we are going to retake our temple from the pagans. And they did it. They also had their problems. They eventually became corrupt and fell away. But you know how righteous those people, righteous in the sense of how dedicated they were to following the law of Moses? They would not do anything on the Sabbath, including fight a battle. And one of the downfalls of the Maccabeans happened to be that the Romans, when they were coming in and Demetrius Soter and some of these other guys who were fighting against them, trying to take back their part of the land, when they realized that these guys wouldn't fight on the Sabbath, guess when they showed up for battle? Saturday morning. And at least a couple of times, these men were so focused on obeying God that they stayed in their camps, in their tents, and let the foreign army come through and slaughter them, that they would not violate the Sabbath. Isn't that amazing? Eventually, they gave that up, and that's when they started turning away from God. That's it. We'll stop.